On these Sunday nights, we've been looking at the Sermon on the Mount, and so we're up to Matthew chapter 5, verse 31 through 32, and we sort of laughed last week, and I'll share it again, but you remember, this is the Word of God, right? And thanks be for it, right? Okay. So that's the introduction. I'd like to read verse 31 and 32 and then move to Matthew chapter 19 and read verses 3 through 10. 3 through 9 will be on the screen, but I'd like to read verse 10 as well. So Jesus is speaking. He's talking about what it means to be kingdom people. He's talking about what it means to live in the new age that he has initiated. And he is in the midst of saying, you have heard it said, but I say to you. In other words, you've heard the teachers say it this way, but I'm saying to you that you need to do even more than what the teachers of the law are telling you to do, in essence. So verse 31 says this, furthermore, it has been said, whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce. But I say to you that whoever divorces his wife for any reason except sexual immorality causes her to commit adultery, and whoever marries a woman who is divorced commits adultery. Now, Matthew chapter 19, verse 3. The Pharisees also came to him, testing him and saying to him, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for just any reason? And he answered and said to them, have you not read that he who made them at the beginning made them male and female, and said, for this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So then they are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore what God has joined together, let not man separate. They said to him, why then did Moses command to give a certificate of divorce and to put her away? And he said to them, Moses, because of the hardness of your hearts, permitted you to divorce your wives, but from the beginning it was not so. And I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for sexual immorality and marries another commits adultery, and whoever marries her who is divorced commits adultery. And then verse 10 says, his disciples said to him, if such is the case of a man with his wife, it is better not to marry. You got to love those guys, right? If you can't get out of it, don't get in it. That's their philosophy. I think that you understand the state of Western culture in regards to marriage. And I don't know what it's been like that you see studies that say, you know, marriage is making a comeback over the last 10 or 15 years. And I don't know that I can speak to that one way or another. I do know that the divorce rate has seemingly held at 40 to 50%. In fact, I think for the first marriage, it's 41%. For second marriages, it's up around 60%. For third marriages, it's up around 75%. So about 50%, you take all of those averages together. I read something interesting that was recent. And it just makes sense because we're having lesser kids. But statistically now in America, according to this study, the likelihood is that a woman will have more husbands in her lifetime than children right now. Because we're having on average less than two children. Like, I don't know, like 1.8 or something. I don't know. But with the divorces, women will there's a stronger chance you'll have more husbands than children. That's sort of interesting, isn't it? And not in a good way, by the way, but it's sort of interesting. And then something has changed because you go back 30, 40 years, the vast majority of divorces 30 to 40 years ago were begun or instigated by the husbands, but now the majority of divorces are instigated by the wives. And so you can give thanks perhaps for some things that the women's revolution or the women's feminism has brought us, but I think that's probably one of the negative things, and I would name more than one or two. But that's just me. I'm a white male, so what can I say? But in any case, I'm not the biggest fan of feminism. But you have these statistics. And so we know that there is an issue. And it's easy sometimes to look at individuals who are in the midst of significant marriage issues and to quite honestly sympathize. I have someone that is very dear to me, and they're in the midst of a marriage. And it's just, for me, it's just a battlefield. And I try to encourage them, but there's a part of me that hangs up the phone and says, you know, they ought to really just get a marriage. No, I can't, divorce, pardon me. I can't say that, but I'm saying I don't think I could live in what they're doing. And I'm trying to encourage them to stay in there and to keep going and to try to work this thing out. But the sympathetic part of me says, boy, what a mess they've got. Just what a disaster that thing is. So in one sense, we can sympathize. In one sense, you have the, there are many people who get married who decide that for whatever reason that they would be happier apart. But from the scriptures that I read, as best that I can tell, Jesus Christ doesn't feel that way, because in his opinion, divorce is a deviation from God's design. I think that's what Jesus is saying in these passages. Because first of all, what he's saying is that it's a deviation from God's design for marriage to become more human than divine. And divorce makes it human instead of divine. It's interesting here, isn't it, that when the Pharisees come to him and they're talking, what they do is they surface the teachings of Moses. They go to Deuteronomy chapter 24, and the first five or six verses there talks about divorce. And they come to Jesus and say, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any reason? And they surface the law of Moses. They surface the certificate of divorce. And so they want to talk about the teachings of Moses. They say, let's talk about what Moses wrote. Let's talk about what Moses said, because Moses allowed for divorce. There were two stipulations with Moses. The first stipulation was that if you wanted to have a divorce, there had to be a written bill of divorcement. It had to be in writing. Right? It just had to be in writing. And the reason for that, I think, is pretty plain, pretty simple. In the Old Testament, adultery was a stonable offense. And so I think that really did protect the women as much as anything, because it had to be in writing so that if a husband wanted to divorce his wife, there had to be evidence so that it just wasn't her word against his and she goes off and then he can come along and say, hey, she's committing adultery, stone her. No, there's a written bill of divorcement in she had the paperwork. The bill went to her and he could send her out, but it had to be in writing. In other words, even under Moses, it didn't matter if you intended to get divorced. It wasn't divorced till the paperwork was filed. So if you're a woman here today and you're sitting down at the coffee shop and a guy comes up to you and says, I'd like to buy you a cup of coffee. And he begins to talk to you, and you're single, and he knows that, and he's talking, and he says, you know what, wouldn't you like to go out sometime, and maybe you'd like to go out with him, but you're talking, and somehow marital status comes up, and he says, now we're separated, but the divorce isn't final. The biblical response to that gentleman is to look at him and say, I don't date married men. See, that's the biblical response. Because until the paperwork is filed, he's married. He doesn't have a bill of divorcement. And it probably ought to be in your vocabulary to say, and when you get your bill of divorcement, don't call me, because I don't date men who cheat on their wives either. See, that's the thing. You had to have the piece of paper. Moses said, and have the piece of paper, and he said, if you find some uncleanness in her, and we'll talk about that in just a minute, he said, you can give her a bill of divorcement. That's all right. But then there's a second part of that, law of Moses. You had to give her the bill of divorcement, but once you divorce her, you could never remarry her again. You can't go Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor. You can't get married twice to the same person. You can't do something like that. Once you divorce her, it's final. And I think that that probably was given for men to think about it, because if you write that bill of divorce and 6 hours later you decide, ooh, I want her back, you can't go back. You divorced her. You're divorced for life. And so I think that Moses gave that so that people would at least take the divorce very, very seriously. So that's what the Pharisees want to talk about. What about Moses' bill of divorcement? Why would Moses give a bill of divorcement? So they're talking about this context. Now, I should say before I move on, you can only even apply or even ask for a divorce. Deuteronomy 24:1 says, if there was an uncleanness in her, would be the King James Version, or something indecent about her. Something indecent about her, or there's an uncleanness. So the Jews debated the meaning of that word. What does it mean for a man to find something indecent or unclean in her? Because then that would be the only way that he could divorce her. There were two schools. There was a conservative school and a liberal school. The conservatives said uncleanness or an indecency is some type of sexual, violation that's short of adultery. Because remember, you could not have divorced a woman for adultery, could you? Because what happened if a woman committed adultery? She got stoned. I mean, under the Mosaic law, under the law of Moses. So that, but there would be an uncleanness in the sense that she didn't commit adultery, but she did something perhaps of a sexual nature that would be considered unclean or flirtatious. Maybe she went out in public without her veil. Maybe she she was alone in a situation with another man by herself. It was just her and him, but there's no evidence that adultery was committed. But it was an indecent thing for her to be alone with a man that she wasn't married to. Maybe she showed her ankles. Maybe she was in the house. She took her hair down when a man was there. But there was something of a flirtatious or a sexual nature. But it wasn't adultery, but it could be deemed as on the road sort of to adultery. And so in that case, she could be divorced. The conservatives would have said that's what it means to be unclean or indecent. Now, there were others who said, no, it's a broader situation. There's a guy named Hillel, who was a major Jewish theologian and influenced a lot of people. And he said indecent means anything you don't like about her. And he would say, if she burns your food, divorce her. If you don't like it, divorce her. It's indecent. It's unclean. It's an awful thing she did. I mean, basically anything she did, she gets in bed at night and she didn't wash her feet or something. She's got filthy feet. Just divorce. I don't know. And you may not be a theologian, but when Jesus is talking, who do you think most of the Jews agreed with? Just knowing human nature. Yeah, divorce her for any reason, right? Most of them are liberal. Yeah, can her, get her out. You can divorce for any reason. And that's what they say. Is it okay to divorce a woman for just any cause? And that's what they want to talk about. But again, it's interesting that Jesus doesn't talk about Moses. They're asking him about Moses, but he says, I don't want to talk about Moses. I want to talk about in the beginning. I'm not going to talk to you about Moses right now. He says, I wanted to go all the way back to the beginning and tell you what the Creator said when He created them. And He said in verse 4 of Matthew 19, He said, have you not read that He made them in the beginning, made them male and female, and for this reason a man shall leave his his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. He said, I'm not going to talk to you about the law of Moses right now. I'm not going to get into that. I want to take you back. And in the beginning, marriage is a divine thing. God created it. He ordained it. And so it is divine. And you're sitting around as men trying to discuss, you know, when is it okay to get married? I mean, when is it okay to stay married? When can you divorce? When can you do that? And he's saying, it's not your business. You have to go back to the divine nature and how it was instituted at the beginning. That's what's important. He says it's divine. It's not human. It was given by God. And it's not for you guys to just sit around and play with. So he says you've deviated because you've made it human and it's divine. Now, secondly, he says that marriage has deviated from the plan of God or from the will of God when it becomes an arrangement rather than the joining of flesh. And that's what he's talking to, I think, to these guys. I mean, they marry and they would divorce, they would remarry. You know, in fact, and by the way, that's among the Pharisees, but Tacitus, who was a Roman historian, said that when Rome got to its lowest point morally, and that was really in the generation, or really a couple generations past when Jesus was alive, he said, and he said it facetiously, but it showed the reality of the situation. He said, we don't count how many, we don't determine a woman's age by how many years old she is. We determine her age by how many husbands she's had. But that's the culture. And it was an arrangement. And if you didn't like the arrangement, you tried to get out of it. And he's saying marriage is not this kind of, it's not given as an arrangement so two people can come together and have some kind of agreement where their needs are met. And I got to be careful here. But probably most of the marriages are that. Most marriages are that. Most marriages probably are, to some degree, two people coming together and we like each other and, I think that my life would be better if you were in it and maybe I could, your life would be better if I was in it and our finances would be better and of course, we really like the way each other looks, so that'll be nice and we can sort of delegate and there sort of is in some ways this arrangement and you can see the marriage going south when the male or the female stops, putting in as much as the other person thinks they ought to be putting in, It seems like a lot of modern marriages, that's sort of the way that it is. I've talked to guys and it's like, I married her and she doesn't clean anymore. Never cooks anymore. Guys talk like this, by the way. She's not cooking anymore. And you know what? When I got her, she was so ambitious. She doesn't want to work anymore. She wants to stay home with the kids. Can you believe something like that? And what's he saying? He's saying, I don't know, because, it was sort of like, we'd get married and she would do this stuff and she would work and it would be better financially, but she's not coming through on her end and I don't know that I want to stay in this thing. What's he talking about? Why is he saying that? Because it was an arrangement. It was a social arrangement. Notice Jesus said, it's not an arrangement. It's the coming together of flesh. It's divine. And God has designed for you not to reach some kind of arrangement, but to commit to each other as one flesh, as one body. And again, we've talked about this before, but how committed are you to your own body? I mean, it's life and death. My dad was in a wreck, and I think I've told several of you this. Probably, I think I've used it a lot in preaching. Probably, I can't remember. It's Sunday night. I'll remember everything. I'm sharper Sunday morning. But, and not always that sharp. He's in a motorcycle wreck about 5 years ago, and his foot was amputated at the scene. He was on a motorcycle, came into contact with a UPS truck, and his foot was cut off at the scene. And we didn't know much of what was going on. We got called by the EMT. They airlifted him from the scene of the accident to Carolina's Medical Center. So we're driving, and we're getting there, and he's in surgery when we get there. All we know that it's been a very brutal wreck. We know motorcycle, UPS truck. We don't really know if he's going to live, and nobody's going to tell us anything. And we're sort of sitting in the waiting room, and it's almost surreal because we're sitting there and they won't tell us anything, but someone comes in and says, they give us this plastic bag and they say, here's his clothes. The helmet's in there, and so it's like, now here we go, because we sort of know what shape he's in by where the blood's at, don't we? So I remember opening that bag, and the helmet's dented up, but it's not broken, so maybe he doesn't have any head damage. And then the shirt's got some blood, but it looks like handprints. Doesn't look like there was a piercing of the skin on the shirt. And then the pants, and the one leg is really bloody, and there's only one shoe. Yeah. Okay. But the doctor comes in, and she says, you know what? We have the foot, and we're going to try to reattach the foot. The legs, the bones have been ripped out, and the legs are sticking out of the flesh. The foot is there. We're going to try to reattach the foot, but we can't really promise anything. Now, Dad's out. He doesn't know what's going on. And I just remember sitting there, and she said, you know, essentially, he's going to live. You know, the next couple of days are going to be difficult, but, you know, he's going to live. Vital organs are okay. And I'm sitting there thinking, because I said, I hope that they're not able to reattach the foot. I'm sitting there thinking, because if they attach that foot, it could never be right. If they attach that foot, he's going to have 30 surgeries to get that thing right. They'll attach it. He's never going to be able to walk on that thing. It's always going to be in pain. I hope that they just do the amputation, particularly if it's below the knee, and then he can get on about his life. But I was just hoping that they wouldn't attach the foot, because I knew if they did, and it was a bad situation, when he woke up, he'd have never let them take that foot off. And he wouldn't have. And he talks to me, and you know, today he said, you know, I missed my foot. I wish they would have tried. And I'm sitting there saying, I'm glad they didn't, because you still wouldn't be walking on that foot. Now, that's just a disagreement. It's his foot, but he was attached to that foot. Attached to that. I got a brother-in-law, and he fell off a building. He was on crutches. He had broken his leg. He had it in a boot. He was up there, but, you know, he's a guy. It was a metal building, and he left the crutches on the ground, but he's in the boot. He's up there. The boot hits the metal. He falls at least 20 feet to the pavement, lands on his feet. The heels go up into him. And even now, when you see him, his heels are up above his shoe line. And he's been in pain for years. He wouldn't be in pain if he would just go ahead, take the feet off, do it. I mean, it looks awful. You have no quality of life. You'll never have any quality of life like that. You're in constant pain. You won't let him take the feet off. He's attached. It doesn't matter how bad they hurt. He's keeping his feet. And I bet you feel like that. He's one flesh, man. It's one flesh. I don't know. I don't care how much pain it is. I'm keeping it. And that's what Jesus is saying. Marriage is designed to be one flesh. It's designed for two people to come together and make this commitment. And the commitment is so strong that divorce shouldn't even really occur to them. just shouldn't really occur to them. It wouldn't even occur to me that, you know what, I would be better off if I cut off one of my limbs, or it would be better off. No, I mean, even when it's painful to have it, when it's painful to have him, when it's painful to have her, it wouldn't even cross your mind because you're one flesh. Jesus is saying that that's what God designed marriage to be. That's what, in the beginning, that's what the originator thought marriage ought to be. It's divine. It's divine coming together into one flesh. And then I think Jesus says, we also deviate when we think of marriage, and I've already touched on this, so I won't talk about it very much. When we think of marriage as anything less than permanent, and I think that's implied in the coming together of one flesh, it has deviated from what God intended for it to be if you think of it in any sense in this life as temporal. Marriage was designed as divine, coming together as flesh, permanently. It's a permanent relationship, at least in this life. Now, there's no marriage in heaven, so that's your out, right? Just make it till you die and you'll be home free. You in a bad marriage? Make it till the time you die and you'll be free. That's all. I'm joking. Not really. I didn't say it as well as I could have, but that's about the size of it. It's permanent. It's permanent. Whatever comes in sickness and in health, for richer, for poorer, for better or worse. I mean, when you say those vows, understand, you're making a vow of permanence. Marriage vows aren't coming together to say, I love you very much and I think that you're a wonderful person and you're a great person. And I've been looking all over town for, 10 years and I haven't found anybody better than you that wanted to be married to me. And that's not what marriage is about. It's about this commitment. It's whatever comes, The eyes over coffee look so very sweet. Will not look the same over shredded wheat. That's just the way it is. But it doesn't matter. Doesn't matter what it looks like 5 years later at breakfast. You're in there, and it's again whoever comes, right? Marriage is whoever comes. It's very possible, and I know this is an extremely unromantic thing to say, but it's a very realistic thing to say. It's very possible that when you get married, at some point in your life, if it's only for 30 minutes, you'll look at a person and say, you know what? We're more compatible than my mate and I are. I mean, and that's one, by the way, that's one of the reasons why you have to stay together and you have to work together and you really have to put a lot of work in your marriage, because you do grow, and for the marriage to be successful, you've got to grow together. Because if you're not working on the marriage, both of you do grow, and you do grow apart, and then that makes it a lot easier for someone to come into your life, and you know what, they're a lot more like you, you have a lot more in common with them, you're a lot closer to them because you haven't worked on the marriage and you've grown apart, and your interests are different, and now you've met this person who's got a lot more similar interest in you than your mate would have. But having said all that, it's possible that in your life, and obviously you would never voice that, you'd be an idiot to voice that, but it is possible in your life that you meet a person at some point, someday, somewhere, and you say, you know what? Particularly if you're in a bad place in your marriage, you say, that person, we're a lot more compatible. But marriage is for whatever comes, and it's for whoever comes. It's that kind of commitment. So that's what Jesus is saying about marriage. It's divine. It's two people coming together as one flesh in a permanent relationship. Now you say, well, aren't there grounds for divorce, though? And Jesus surfaces one. He says, as I understand what he's saying here, he's saying, if you divorce for any reason other than adultery, as I understand it, that's a sin. Or at least, at the very, very least, a deviation from God's will for your life. And I would say that it's a sin, but at the very least, you have to say it's a deviation of God's will for your life. It's not the unpardonable sin. It's not the unpardonable sin. You can be forgiven for that, but I think still it is a sin. He said, unless it's for adultery. Now, Paul will surface in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 15, that another potential reason for divorce that would be acceptable is abandonment. But again, it's interesting if you look at 1 Corinthians 7:15, it says if you have an unbelieving spouse and they leave you and they don't want to be married to a Christian anymore, then, you know, there's really nothing that you could do about that. But even in that context, verse 11 says, but I'd rather you stay unmarried and try to resolve that as much as you can. Stay unmarried, resolve that situation. But again, it says if you have an unbelieving spouse and they don't want to be married to a Christian, walk away. Paul was still, I think, would be astounded at the ideal of two Christians getting a divorce. Saying if you're married to an unbeliever and they just don't want to be married to a Christian. But I don't think Paul in that situation is imagining that divorce would be in the realm of possibility for two Christians. But again, he surfaces the ideal that if somebody abandons you and they don't want to be married, they walk out. I mean, there's nothing you can do about that. So you have adultery and abandonment as, you know, justifiable means for divorce. Now, some would add others and say, but doesn't it seem reasonable that for your safety you could divorce? What if you're married to an abusive person? And I think that at the very least you've got to separate in that situation. You need to, I mean, you have to protect yourself and particularly your children in that situation. Some would say, well, what about, you know, you could go on and on. Well, what about if a person loses their mental faculties? You're married to somebody and they end up institutionalized and then, well, what are you going to do? There's all kinds of what ifs, but I would just caution you to not speak past where the scriptures speak. And so I can't speak past where the scriptures speak. Scriptures say adultery and abandonment. The others, I think I could say, are reasonable, but the scriptures don't speak to that. And we must not speak past where the scriptures speak. And I would encourage you that while it makes sense, that we have to be careful, again, not to go past the scriptures. It's interesting, by the way, here, that when the Pharisees are talking, Jesus, when he talks about adultery, uses the word porneia instead of mokia in the Greek, which a lot of commentators say is very strange because really the word for adultery, where there's a husband and he's cheating on his wife, in the Greek it's mokia, but Jesus says porneia. And some commentators say, why would he use porneia, which is broader, and where we get our word pornography from? And they say, you know, among the Pharisees, they had tried to come up with so many loopholes that they would say that a relationship with a prostitute wasn't adultery because adultery had to have a relationship, and the only way you could really technically commit adultery is if you were with a person and having a relationship with them, but you don't have a relationship, personal relationship with a prostitute, so you can go to a prostitute without technically committing adultery. So Jesus has to say porneia. Any of it. You want to parse the word, I'm just going to throw it out there. Sexual sin. But again, they were loophole seekers. And you and I must not be loophole seekers on this issue. It's not for us to say, it's not for you and I to go past the scriptures. I want to close with what Jesus says here, because he comes down to the end and this is his conclusion, so it will be mine. He said, I just want to remind you that while there are lots of reasons for adultery, for divorce, you go down and people get a divorce and they write irreconcilable differences, or they write incompatible, or they write, you know, mental cruelty or whatever. And there's a lot of those. He said, actually, there's only one reason that people get divorced. You see that? Verse 8. He said to them, Moses, because of the hardness of your hearts, permitted you to divorce your wives. But from the beginning, it was not so. Jesus is saying, ultimately, The only cause, the only reason people get a divorce is because they allow their hearts to get hard. They kept their hearts soft, divorce would not come up. Somebody in the relationship, one or both, allowed their hearts to get hard. Their hearts weren't soft. They weren't tender towards each other. They quit forgiving each other. They quit going the extra mile with each other. They quit both doing 100%. And again, that was one or both. It was due to the hardness of their hearts. And I would just encourage you who are married today, guard your hearts. Your marriage is secure. You don't need to worry about getting a divorce as long as your hearts stay tender. The only way you could ever get a divorce, and maybe some of you are thinking about getting married and you say, you know what, everybody in my family's got a divorce and I don't know that I want to get married. Get married, but keep your hearts tender. The only reason you would ever get a divorce is due to the hardness of your heart. What does having a tender heart look like? I'll say this in close. It's basically how you respond to your kids. Most of us are very tender-hearted to our kids. We forgive them. We go the extra mile. We work hard. We stand by them even though they don't deserve it. Everybody else thinks that your kid's a little creep, but all you can see is somebody wonderful and somebody who's going to get it together in their life someday. You know what? If we would treat our spouses like we treat our kids, we'd have a lot stronger marriages. And that's the ironic thing, isn't it? Because we're not called to be one flesh with our kids. We're called to be one flesh with each other. You know, as a parent, our goal is to raise our kids, and to raise our kids means that we raise them up so that they go out and become one flesh with somebody else, not with us, one flesh with somebody else. But it's interesting that it seems like, to some degree, we become one flesh with our kids and people that we're married to. We have a much lesser commitment to them than we do our children. And maybe that's understandable. I think God has given that to us. But your heart, the way you are towards your kids, that tends to be what tender-hearted is, and we need to be that way towards each other. Beware of the hardness of your heart. Okay. Well, that's divorce. I won't have to preach on that for another 5 years, right? I won't preach about it again until somebody gets a divorce. So take care of your marriages, you know. Okay? I'm sorry. That's a bad thing to say. All right. Let's stand.